Welcome to the official podcast of the San Francisco Shakespeare Festival. The following conversation, Mercy and Revenge Through the Lens of Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, was held by SF Shake's education director Carl Holvig Thomas at St. Cyprian's Turk and Lion Group on October 2nd, 2014.
So right now I'm directing The Merchant of Venice with a group of teenagers in Palo Alto right now. This play has brought up some of the most controversial discussions we've had. We actually were doing some exercises of this, working on this play in our resident artist meeting, a whole bunch of theater artists who get together and try and improve our work and our craft and things. And it, like, the exercises, like, we had to shut things down. People were getting seriously offended. People were seriously upset about some things. It just brought up so much passion in people that I'm excited but also a little nervous for today. but in any case, I think that in talking about this play and some of the things that I'd like to focus on ultimately are the themes that it brings up around mercy and around revenge as well. And so I think before we can dive right into mercy and revenge, we need some steps to get us there first. A little bit of background about Shakespeare, when he wrote this play, what was going on in the time, I think would be useful. Then probably talk a little bit about the play. I'm assuming people don't already know it, so I'd love to introduce what happens in the play. And then there's a couple of speeches that I think we can look at and kind of just do a little close reading of and try and distill if there are any kernels of knowledge and wisdoms that we can take from it. So,
how many play you wrote? Yeah.
I'm sorry?
How many play you wrote?
How many plays did he write?
So he wrote, and this is disputed, and a lot of these facts tonight, things that come across as facts are disputed, but we'll say maybe about 38 plays or so that he wrote, and then he wrote
some
it.
Some of the famous, some of the not so famous, yeah?
yeah, exactly. You have Hamlet and Romeo and Juliet on the famous side, and you have Timon of Athens and Coriolanus on the not so famous side, and Merchant of Venice falls somewhere in the middle there, where it's actually considered one of his problem plays, because The Merchant of Venice is called a comedy, the comedy of The Merchant of Venice. I tell my students, you can always tell whether a play is a comedy or a tragedy by, at the end, are people dying or are people getting married? And yeah, exactly. That's what they were discussing over in Oakland today.
I know they're making a movie.
Yes, a movie with Al Pacino.
Yeah, maybe the one I made early, I don't know. I just know the one Al Pacino.
Right, yeah, exactly. So, he was in
about
the movie. What's that?
What's so funny about getting married?
I don't know. Apparently Shakespeare thought it was. He had a sense of humor about it, apparently, I guess.
Probably. He was probably a bachelor.
Right. He did have a wife, but anyways, that's another story for another time. Let me focus in a little bit on turn back the clock a little to about 1590 in Elizabethan England, all right? So England, some of, you know, the things that we can think about, England had a massive navy at the times, you know, world-famous explorers coming out of there, sailing all across the world, and that opens up all new types of things, like, new trade avenues, new interactions with other people, all of the things, you know, they're bringing people back, unfortunately, to England, and all the issues that brought up, and just, you know, in general, is a real time of discovery and mixing. Had its pros, had its cons, but one of the pros, I think, is that it founded some of these educational institutions that are still around today. It's where you get Oxford and Cambridge, all right? And at Cambridge, in particular, there's one amazing thinker. And he's there and he's studying and he's seeing all of this happen. It's all a very fast moving time from their perspective. And he realizes that this new, call it a melting pot of people, all these people meeting each other and having these interactions and, you know, people who have never really known that other people like this existed in the world are now being pushed together, writes a play about this. And the play that he writes is called The Jew of Malta. And in this play, It's about the island of Malta, a small Italian island off of Italy, and in it there are a bunch of politicians who are really upset because one person, the Jew of Malta, is more wealthy than anyone else and has all the power in the world. Fast forward to the end of the play. The end of the play is the Jewish character is in a cauldron being boiled on stage with everyone standing around watching and saying what a great thing this is. Now, this playwright was actually way ahead of his time, in my opinion. And I'll just preface it now. All of these things, you know, I wasn't obviously around back then. This is my research, how I've come to understand it. People have other facts that they want to bring up. Feel free, by all means. But just how I've come to understand it, that he was actually writing this play in a subversive direction that was supposed to, in Shakespeare's words, hold the mirror up to nature to show people how cruelly they're treating each other and hopefully help them learn from it. Unfortunately, the play was not received that way. It was a very popular play, but everyone just loved to watch this Jewish character get boiled on stage, and it became all the rage to perform this play in that way. Fast forward a couple of years, there's a doctor. His name is Rodrigo Lopez, and he's the Queen's physician. And he comes from Spain, actually originally from Portugal, and he was Jewish at one point, but then converted in Elizabeth in England to be Protestant.
I think the first thing for that, no?
I'm sorry?
The first thing for converting?
He converted because back then
the movement to force the Jews to convert.
Yes, it was forced. In Elizabethan England,
they want to expel them from England.
Yes, there were no openly practicing Jewish people in Elizabethan England, which gives us a lot of perspective when we'll look at the play a little bit later. So keep that in the back of your minds that Shakespeare himself probably never met an openly Jewish person, but. There's Rodrigo Lopez. He's the Queen's physician. And he actually gets accused of plotting to poison and kill the Queen, even though she never, Queen Elizabeth, even though she never got sick or anything. But he was accused of this. And he actually was convicted of treason and treachery. And he was hung in public and drawn and quartered. And so he had a very unfortunate demise, again, to crowds of cheering Elizabethan peasants, you know, or, you know, everybody actually really, just not just the, you know, the common people, but everybody was had this view. Now, the best thinkers of the time, in my mind, were not, you know, if we think about the best thinkers of our time, I don't know, here in Silicon Valley writing apps or something like that, or, you know, turn back the clock a little bit, you know, some of the best thinkers were orchestrating the civil rights movement or writing the Declaration of Independence or who knows, you know, you can think of all these great, great thinkers throughout time. But in Shakespeare's time, those folks sat around in the pubs along the Thames and wrote plays. And so that's where we have Christopher Marlowe, the author of A Jew of Malta and the student in Cambridge. And he has a friend named William Shakespeare. William Shakespeare sees how his play is presented to the public and how, you know, how much they love it for the wrong reasons. And then he sees the execution of Rodrigo Lopez. And then he writes a play called The Merchant of Venice. And that's where we're going to start today. That's the little context about that. If anyone has any questions about that, feel free to ask. Yeah.
Was he already a writer before this?
Yeah, so Shakespeare by this time has written a couple of plays, or they've become pretty popular, and there's sort of this elite group of playwrights there, you know, Christopher Marlowe, who later ends getting killed because he's accused of being a spy and gets stabbed in a bar, stabbed through the eye, actually, and killed. Ben Jonson, another playwright of the time, and William Shakespeare, all sitting around writing plays that we still use today, still perform today.
What time the writer was named Oscar Wilde?
This is after. Yeah, yeah. Oscar Wilde comes. Oscar Wilde.
You're
comes
from England, yeah.
Yes, yes, from England as well.
So, like, what date are we fixed in right now?
Right now, we're looking at about 1596, because 94 is the execution of Rodrigo Lopez. Around 90, 92 is the Jew of Malta. And now, somewhere in between 94 and 96, I believe, and now I'm on record. That's to the best of my memory. Some of those
that's
dates
pretty,
are hard to keep in
that's
mind.
Pretty, that's good.
So yeah. somewhere around that time. Anyway, so the point is he writes this play, A Merchant of Venice. And I'm going to go into the story of Merchant of Venice. There's a made-up Italian island called Belmont. It's this beautiful island out, off the shores of Italy, just idyllic little area. And in there is a princess whose father has recently died. And in his will, what he says is that I'm going to lay out three caskets, and the right suitor who comes along and chooses the correct casket can have your hand in marriage. And so suitors come from all over the world. You get this, in the play, this wonderful rainbow of characters of all these people who come in and try and choose the right casket. It's actually where we get a famous phrase, because the caskets are gold, silver, and lead. And when the Prince of Morocco opens the gold casket, it has a note in it, and it says, "All that glitters is not gold." And it's one of that famous line. Some other suitors come, and they all choose the wrong caskets. Shift over to Venice.
There are only three of them?
There's only three caskets, exactly. And I guess a lot of people were just choosing silver and gold because those were the flashy ones, and no one wanted to pick this lead casket. Shift over to Venice, where it's a big, bustling city, lots of commerce going on at the time. There's, in these, places of economic efficiency economic growth, there's lots of opportunities for investment, and certain people are lending money, and there's a whole religious aspect of it where the Christians weren't allowed to lend money for a fee, weren't allowed to gain interest on it, whereas Jewish residents were able to lend money, and it wasn't against their religion to take interest from it, and it caused tension in the community. And what happens is that there's a young lover named Bassanio, and he really, really wants to go over and try his luck at choosing the caskets. So he asks his friend, who's a very rich merchant in Venice, a very popular guy named Antonio. He says, "Antonio, can I please borrow some money so I can go, get all dressed up and get some big, nice, fancy boats and go and apply for Portia's hand by choosing the casket?" And Antonio says, I would totally do that, but unfortunately, all my ships are out at sea right now. I don't have any money that I can give you right now. But go try my credit in Venice. Go see what my credit, my name can get you in Venice." And so Bassanio eventually meets a character named Shylock. And Shylock is a man of Jewish faith, and he decides to loan Antonio the money. Not as a friend, but instead, because Antonio, who was, this Christian Venetian businessman who's actually very mean to Shylock, the Jewish character, and in the play it talks about him spitting on him, calling him names, and just treating him pretty horribly. Shylock decides that he's going to lend the money to Antonio, but he's going to have a clause in there. And that is, if Antonio doesn't pay him back the money, that he is owed 1 pound of Antonio's flesh closest to his breast. And Antonio enters the bargain. Bassanio does as well. Bassanio gets the money. He goes down. He chooses the right casket. It's lead. He and Portia become married. And everything seems like it's going to be the perfect end to a Shakespearean comedy. It's just going to all turn out well for everyone. When the news comes in that Antonio's ships, which were supposed to have returned by now, have all crash, run into delays and problems, and Antonio doesn't have the money to pay back Shylock. And so he has now forfeited the bond and owes Shylock 1 pound of his own flesh. They decide, Bassanio decides to rush back to Venice and try and help the situation. And Portia and her lady-in-waiting, Nerissa, decide that they're going to go back to Venice as well. But they're going to disguise themselves as lawyers and doctors. And they're going to go back and keep an eye on their husbands while they're back in their hometown of Venice. And so, I see some eyes going back and forth. That's right, I'm always watching. So they do go back to Venice. A dramatic courtroom scene happens, and that's where we're going to be looking at one of the speeches there from that scene, in which, in a surprise turn of events, Portia, disguised as a young lawyer, comes in and tries to resolve the case. Everyone is asking Shylock to show mercy and to take the money now that Bassanio has married the very wealthy Portia. They can pay the money. They can pay twice as much money. They offer to pay three times as much money. And Shylock says, no, I want my pound of flesh. And then Portia comes in disguise as a learned doctor and adjudicates the case or litigates the case and asks him to show mercy. He doesn't, and she finds a technicality in the agreement, which says that you're entitled to a pound of flesh, but you are not entitled to a drop of blood. So you cannot, or so take the pound of flesh, but do not spill his blood, or else you will be executed, essentially, for trying to take the life of a Venetian. And Shylock says, you got me, I surrender, I'm just going to leave. And she says, no, you have to. You have to take a pound of flesh, or else you forfeited on the bond. And so he says, I can't, I'm not going to. And she says that your life is now subject to the Duke. The Duke can decide whether or not to execute you. The Duke says, no, I'm not going to execute you. And then Bassanio, Antonio's friend, says that as a punishment, what should happen is that Shylock should forfeit all of his money and property to the state, and also some to his daughter, who I didn't get into, but who's run away with a Christian character. So you forfeit all your money, and you must convert to Christianity. And Shylock is given the choice of you can be executed or you can take those terms, and he decides to take those terms. And then Act 5 is back in Belmont. Everyone is happy and gets married. And that's pretty much the end of the play. There's some other things that I'm leaving out for the sake of time here. But
I thought that was for the mercy part of tonight's conversation.
Yes, to have mercy on you all, yes. I didn't include everything. But that, in more or less, is about the summary of the play. So it'd be a good time if people have questions on that, things that they didn't quite get or understand or want to ask more about, or things that you thought were interesting about it. Yeah.
How does Shylock come across to the reader? Do you feel compassion towards him? Or?
It's really perfect question. Thank you. In Shakespeare's time, Shylock, the character of Shylock, would have been performed as if this was all a comedy. He would have had a red wig on, and he would have had a bulbous nose on, and it's an over-the-top anti-Semitic characterization of a Jewish character. And then around the 19th century, Edmund Keating, a really famous actor, who I should know for sure that that's his name, but I think it's Edmund Keating, performed Shylock in a more sympathetic way. And since then, the performances have really brought out the more sympathetic side of him. But it does bring up, an interesting part, that Shakespeare never met or knew openly Jewish people if he was in England the whole time.
Well, you got information about Jewish people.
Right. So all he was working on was other people's interpretations and the really awful stereotypes about them, and that's what he had to work with. And in Merchant of Venice in particular, there's a speech that's hotly debated where he talks about losing his daughter. I mentioned briefly his daughter runs away with a Christian fellow, and they go off to Belmont. Mm-hmm. But he has this speech where he talks about my daughter, my ducats. My money, my daughter, my ducats, and everyone tries to figure out, well, does he care more about his money or his daughter? And so that's one place where people who are of the opinion that Merchant of Venice is an anti-Semitic play would point to as a place where that's reinforcing this stereotype straight up, you know, just that he's greedy and cares only about money. So, you know, our own culture has gone through, all the cultures that perform this have gone through an arc of the play of how they are performing it. And it's something that Steve was talking a lot about, I think, about over the director over at Midnight Oakland is, you know, where is this play a comedy and where is it a tragedy? There are certainly funny scenes and funny characters and clowns in the play, and it ends like a comedy. But we've really, you know, found something tragic about it in it as well, and that's why it's one of Shakespeare's. We get a great what they call a pants roll, which is female characters dressing up as male characters and coming in and subverting male authority. There's a bunch of great Shakespeare plays like that. And keep in mind in that time that women weren't allowed on stage, so these are young teenage boys dressing up as women who are dressing up as men who are subverting male authority. It's quite the mind jumbling. And when you look at the text, and we're not going to focus on that point tonight, but if you look at the text, there's little jokes to it.
How did the story end in Venice? Why you pick a Venice?
I'm sorry?
Why is it in Venice?
Why is it in Venice? Well, Venice is...
Have you been there?
It's going to be...
Because.
Yeah, why not Venice? It sounds like a great place.
Is it a nice place or is it...
Well, something I do know about Venice is that this is the time where Jewish people were put into certain neighborhoods, and it's actually, I think, where we derive the term ghetto now, uh-huh. Coming from a group of people who are moved into
England,
a certain part of the neighborhood.
Is not the Jewish expelled from England?
Yes, yeah. No openly Jewish people in England. And in Venice, the Jewish people live in a ghetto.
They move, though.
Yeah, exactly. So why would Shakespeare set it in Venice? It would be because that would be a location that everyone knows has a real strong interaction of Christians and Jewish people.
Because that's where the Jews are.
More or less. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question, because it sounds like he was written as a slightly anti-Semitic character, Shylock.
Yeah.
But then when you were describing the history preceding when you described the story, it sounded like he said, oh, wow, the other play is hyper-anti-Semitic, mm-hmm. people aren't getting its subversive nature, and wow, this guy just got executed in an anti-Semitic...
Yeah.
For being Jewish in some mm-hmm. senses, or mm-hmm. for being Jewish in the past. So it seems like, I would think he came as like a... wanted to maybe write it.
Right.
In a
why would you? Why wouldn't you make him just the most benevolent, right. nicest person? It's interesting. Well, a couple of things. I mean, first, you know, if you think of the end of Jew of Malta, which is actually trying to kind of be a progressive play, in my opinion, and this, at least he's not gruesomely, you know, killed at the end of that. But wouldn't they see that as a good thing? I mean,
right.
you know, I like to think that Shakespeare was sensitive to how traumatic that would be for somebody to do, but I think that on the scale of what the Elizabethan public could handle, him actually just sort of converting and moving away quietly at the end is not quite the extreme that they're probably used to with the more, you know, gruesome forms of entertainment around then. They were really used to some horrific things. I mean, bear baiting. We did Taming of the Shrew this summer, and that's another play that brings up a lot of issues with the gender norms that it has. And Shakespeare was writing that in response to where at the end of the play, the shrew character, the unruly wife, was wrapped in horse skin and salted and just and whipped and just like all these horrific things. So even though now we see the end of Taming of the Shrew where she says in a big speech about, you know, getting along with your husband, we see that now. It's like, ooh, I don't know. But at least relative to what Shakespeare was responding to, it was actually, you know, a pretty revolutionary idea to not have them horrifically tortured at the end of it. But you're right. And it's something that I still grapple with in directing this play with my students is, you know, there are those aspects of it that reinforce anti-Semitic stereotypes. And so it's one of the problems in the problem play. Yeah. Yeah. Nice. Thank you.
How Christian do you think Shakespeare was? Because it seems to me like based on his plays, like they were pretty, like, I would say forward, mm-hmm. at least within the culture of the time. I would mm-hmm. say that, like, it seems to me like he was more like part of that for cultural reasons rather than like being
certainly.
An evangelical
yeah.
for the faith or something.
Yeah, I mean, all these plays are being highly censored at the time. George isn't here. He always talks about the King James version of the Bible, and that's being written. That's written maybe 10 years later after this, and he. but I think for what was going on in that time, all the censorship and everything, he had to be really careful about what he put up on stage. When King James came into power and Queen Elizabeth left, King James shut down all the theaters and they stopped doing Shakespeare. They stopped doing all the plays. They shut down all the theaters. And because they were too unruly, basically, they were like reality TV now. You know, that's what he thought. He's like, I just need to censor it all out. So he had to be careful, and he had to, you know, make plays that were popular. He was, like artists now, had to meet the bottom line as well. You know, Shakespeare's most famous play during that time, actually, was Titus Andronicus, which is one of his most gruesome plays, where people are horrifically, you know, arms cut off, tongues cut out, raped, all sorts of awful things, and people loved it. So
he wrote a slasher film.
So there are a couple slashers in the canon as well. Yeah, pretty much.
What's the tie-in now to, wasn't the theme of this going to be mercy?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So how does the play...
Yeah.
Oh, Mercy and Revenge.
Mercy and Revenge, yeah, exactly. So there are two speeches that I have for us here, and they deal really closely with the themes of mercy and revenge. One of them is Shylock's speech, the Jewish character in the play, who has a great speech, which is actually, I think, along the lines of what we're all wanting in this, which... a sympathetic take on the character. And so we'll take a look at that. Yeah, we can pass them around. And then on the back, there's the Portia speech. And that's her in the courtroom asking Shylock to show mercy on Antonio. But let's go chronologically. What's that? Yeah, so tonight we're going to look at two different speeches, one on revenge, one on mercy, and then we'll see if they speak to each other in any way. So we're going to start with the Shylock speech. It's the speech that says Salarino at the top. I don't know why Shakespeare did this. In this play, there's a character named Salarino, named Solanio, and Salario. He's just trying to, like, confuse me. I don't know. But in any case...
baby's name.
Yeah, exactly. So I'd love for us to take a look at this speech and just kind of read through it first and then maybe start to unpack it a little bit. And I didn't know how long to prepare this, so if anyone has to leave or anything like that, I totally won't be offended. I completely understand it's a long night.
Plus, the Packers are kicking the Vikings.
Oh, football is something to go out. Gotta catch that.
Tonight?
Speaking of, I gotta...
Yeah.
I'm over it now. We've got so many mean players.
Cool.
Actually, it's connected to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to read through this speech. I'd love for me not to talk the whole time. Anders had everyone else reading when we were looking at some Bible sections a few weeks ago, and I thought that was wonderful. I'd like to do something similar. So if we could maybe just read, for this Shylock speech, let's just read to every punctuation mark that's not a comma. Meaning, if it's a comma, keep on reading, but if it's a question mark, a colon, a semicolon, anything like that. Thanks, man. Thanks for coming. It was awesome to see you. Yeah. Anything like that, then we'll pass it on to the next person. So hopefully,
should we read like everyone will get an actor?
So, oh man, you're trying to.
I'd like to see what that looks like.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Okay. So,
if you want,
you're just trying to like get it all my
it
pet peeves.
Might help us get better into
all
it.
My pet peeves today. So my thing is, so many people. Well, I teach Shakespeare for a living. It's just what I do. And so many people would say, "So do I have to be like Shakespearean now, or like have a British accent now?" And I'm telling them, no. What we think of as the British accent now was not the same as it was in Shakespeare's time. It was very different. In fact, if you think about it. Shakespeare, 1600, right? Columbus is in a, you know, half a century about to make his way over here and bring a whole bunch of British people over here. And so these people have come over and they keep their accent. So if you go back and
they're... Hi, thanks for coming.
So nice to meet you. Stay in touch. So if you think about it, and people have actually studied this and tried to, they call it original pronunciation. They do entire shows in what like is the classic way that they think Shakespeare was Shakespearean people were talking at that time, and it's actually in some ways more similar to an American accent, and it's not at all that heightened kind of stiff upper lip British stereotype that you would think of, you know. And so no one feel any pressure to perform this or put on any funny accents for it or hold skulls or something. just read it just so we can all get the gist of what he's talking about it. Anyone want to start out? Anders, you're going to start out. I'll give you your cue line, okay?
Okay.
And just read to the first, important punctuation mark.
Okay.
So Salarino, let me give a little more context on the speech. He's just found out that Antonio's ships are delayed and that they may not be there in order to pay his debt in time. And Salarino asks Shylock, Salarino's a Christian character, he asks Shylock, "Why, I am sure if he forfeit, thou will not take his flesh. What's that good for?"
I was going to do my accent. To bait fish with all. To bait fish with all.
Good.
Yeah. If it feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge.
He hath disgraced me and hindered me 500,000.
Laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation. Am I keep going?
Yeah, please.
Thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies.
And what's his reason?
I am a Jew.
Hath not a Jew eyes.
Hath not a Jew hands, organs, dimensions, senses, affections, passions.
I don't know what I'm saying.
No way.
Fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons,
no, totally
subject to the same diseases, healed by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. Why don't you continue?
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
If you prick us,
do we not bleed?
If you tickle us, do we not laugh?
If you poison us, do we not die?
And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge?
If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that.
If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility?
Revenge.
If a Christian wrong a Jew, what should his sufferings be by Christian example?
Why? Revenge.
The villainy you teach me, I will execute, and it shall go hard. But I will better the instruction.
Nice, nice. Good. Were there any questions on like words or sense of what he's saying here? I don't know, what are some of the more difficult words in this? It's a pretty straightforward.
I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, like he's saying that he's entitled to revenge.
So yes, exactly.
Because
so Shylock is saying that he's essentially saying in this speech that he's entitled to take revenge on Antonio.
Because he treated me harshly.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
And he's a Christian would do the same thing.
Yes.
Isn't that line, if you prick us, do we not bleed? That's another famous.
That's
this whole section.
Yeah, exactly. A very famous part of the play where he has this. And I think it's because what we're talking about, that it actually brings out the humanness in this character. And you get to see some of the things that Antonio had done to him, all the disgraces that he suffered at Antonio's hand. And then and all of these things, you know, if we prick us, do we not bleed, tickle us, laugh. Those are just wonderful, beautiful images that just, for me, land right in my heart. You know, it just immediately resonates. And then the next part made me think a little. It took me a while to start to understand this. And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that. If a Jew wrong a Christian, what is his humility? Revenge. And so I didn't know why he thought that. Why did Shylock feel that Christians were so vengeful? And it wasn't until I learned about Rodrigo Lopez and that he was executed in this way, and that the Christians all stood around, you know, throwing vegetables at him while he was hung and quartered. I think that maybe.
How did they come to know he was a Jew or he was converted or something?
It was like the worst Law and Order case ever. It was like people were just accusing him based on. I don't know too many facts about the story, but from what I can tell, it seems like people accused him of trying to be loyal to the King of Spain, who had issues with Queen Elizabeth, and then even Queen Elizabeth didn't believe that Rodrigo Lopez was necessarily guilty, and we think that because she gave all of his property to his wife, which if they were following the normal letter of the law, all that property would have been confiscated. But Queen Elizabeth actually stayed his execution. She made it last longer, or not happen until a later time, and then did that. So the reason that she wasn't quick to accuse him is one reason why people might think that he wasn't actually trying to do that.
Yeah, actually, even kings and queens used to get executed.
Yeah, sure.
They used to get beheaded and stuff.
Nice. Yep. Not nice, but right. good. Anything else from the speech? Anything to take a closer look at?
What do you think?
Yeah. Okay, cool. Good, great. So Salarino says that will not take his flesh. You're not going to actually take that pound of flesh from the contract, right? You're not actually going to do that. What's that good for? And he responds to bait fish, you know, for nothing. He's not actually after the flesh. He's going
to... Do people say that now, to bait fish?
Like in a film noir.
Okay.
He's fish food, right?
I think Nelson Mandela made a speech.
It's a much
something
more marine.
Like Nelson Mandela. He made a speech. I think something similar to this. When he was convicted, or when he was called for terrorism or something.
Yeah. Well, he suffered a lot at the hands of apartheid and was in prison for a long period of time. And then when he was, they talk about Nelson Mandela, when he was then asked to form the new government in South Africa, there he asked for truth and reconciliation. And he didn't go back and you know, pin all the people who were horrible to him up against a wall, but he said, be truthful, and then we'll reconcile. So admit what you did wrong, and we'll reconcile. And he didn't. He showed mercy, you know. So I don't know.
You had something, Brian?
Yeah. Well, for me, this the mirroring of the language here reads as a holding up of the mirror to the audience.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Right.
I clearly read it that way.
Yeah. So there's a series of questions, right? I can't even count them this fast. Maybe 10 questions that he asks here. And in Shakespeare's time, the audience was like an integral part of the performance. And so while he would have been asking these questions of the other characters on stage, I can almost bet that he would be going out into the audience and actually directly making eye contact with the audience members, you know, the groundlings on the floor of the Globe, wow, and asking them these questions. And so that...
posing it as a philosophical question as much as a line of dialogue.
Which I'm sure the
first... Right.
Well... Yeah, and there was a very enthusiastic audience.
Oh, yeah. They would have yelled right back at him. You can imagine. I would almost bet. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Nice. So, revenge. That's the speech is a justification for revenge, ultimately, isn't it?
Well, not if you're looking in the mirror.
What do you mean?
Well, he says, you know, a Christian would be entitled to this, so why not me? You know, and he's saying, look, when you do this to me, when I suffer this loss, this is your loss too, mm-hmm, right?
Yeah.
And that's the voice, the author's voice that I'm hearing there, is to make the case to the people that what just happened to Rodrigo Lopez was a huge problem, folks, and we can't be doing that.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly. So. And, you know, I think the Jew and Christian has said so much in this, but ultimately, I don't know, in my mind, it seems like he's getting at that it's not a religious thing, that it's that the pursuit of revenge is such a core human drive and element, that it's something that's in everybody, that sure, that feel to want to do that, to want to take revenge. It's really interesting when we work on this with the at-risk youth in Oakland and talk about revenge and mercy in this context, and that some of the stories that we get out of from their perspectives, mm-hmm, and you know, living in really, really tough circumstances and in tough neighborhoods, and when they talk about revenge and mercy, it, you know, it just brings it to a whole another level of reality, and for them too.
Well, maybe like
it's
they,
really universal.
Maybe it's a controversial thing to say, but I feel like probably young black men have an experience of a Jew in this time period now, in some senses, of kind of the state, feeling like the state is constantly against them and they're constantly being, you know, being punished. And and then when they break, or somebody breaks and causes, and there's some sort of violence returned against a white policeman or something, that is what is exploded, and then they become someone who could be bold,
right,
burned in a cauldron.
No, yeah, you're actually not far off of how we got there. The question was posed to us, why don't we do Othello with this group of students? And we thought about it for a while. We explored Othello with our resident artist company, and we decided that it was just in some ways too on the nose. The racial slurs in that, there's anti-Semitic slurs in this, but the racial slurs in that are very offensive as well. And what we realized, what the urge is to talk about otherness. And that's where we found Merchant of Venice and decided to bring it there. And what was really interesting, what surprised us at the Shakespeare Festival, was that for them, they actually didn't see themselves as other, you know, that they, that it was, they just were them. It was us who were the others, the Shakespeare instructors coming in into, you know, the that neighborhood in West Oakland and doing Shakespeare. We were sort of the outsiders there. And so, it was just a little surprising.
Did they see themselves
twist
as like the Shylock?
I think in some, yeah, I think so. I'm sure. And actually, I'm not in those rehearsal rooms as much, but I imagine that they have experiences that they relate to in some ways when they felt that way. And isn't that I think another universal feeling of I don't know, when I go to a foreign country, I feel that way, or some places here. So yeah. Anything else about revenge? Shall we look at mercy? All right. Let's do it. I wanted to ask Anders about what the Bible says about revenge, if that's ever brought up. Does anyone know more about the Bible than me? The
Bible said if somebody had a planning to kill you, you have the right to go kill him first.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. Yeah. So even like preemptive revenge.
Yeah. For
interesting.
Self-defense.
Or self-defense, yes. Yes. Yeah,
yeah, this is what Israel is doing that all the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we'll go on. We'll look at the mercy speech and see what that is. So in this speech, this is like the big dramatic courtroom scene, Antonio's there. He's ready to have the pound of flesh cut from him. Shylock is there and he's sharpening his knife, and in walks this doctor who says, "Hold everything, Shylock, you need to show mercy." And he says, "On what compulsion must I?" And then they answer, why don't we just read this time just one line of verse at a time, so just one line at a time, and then when it droppeth, that'll be the next person.
The quality of mercy is not strained.
It droppeth as a gentle rain from heaven
upon the place beneath. It is twice blessed.
It blesseth him that gives and him that takes.
His mightiest and the mightiest it becomes.
The throned monarch better than his crown.
The scepter shows the force of temporal power.
Was it capture?
Yes.
His scepter.
What does a scepter mean?
A king's scepter. The king holds a scepter, like a big golden staff, and it's like all his authority and power are derived from it. Yeah. But why don't you go after that? So his scepter shows the force of temporal power.
The force of temporal power.
Good.
The attribute to awe and majesty.
Wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings.
But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings.
It is an attribute to God himself.
An earthly power doth then show likest gods.
When mercy seasons justice. Therefore, Jew,
though justice be thy plea, consider this.
This is in the course of justice. Name of us.
Should see no. Salvation. We do pray for mercy.
And that same prayer doth teach us all to render
the deeds of mercy. I have spoke thus much.
To mitigate the justice of thy plea.
Which, if thou follow this strict court of Venice,
must needs give sentence against the merchant there.
Nice, nice. Good job. So this speech is a little bit more difficult. It's not quite so easy to like get the first time, right? In fact, if you just look at the structure of it, this speech is in verse, meaning it's in Shakespeare's rhythm, his iambic pentameter. Ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. It's the closest rhythm that you can think of to your heartbeat, right? The quality of mercy is not strained. All of these lines have that same meter and that same sort of rhythm to them. And there, it's a more complex argument that she's making. She's dealing in more philosophical terms. She's here, litigating a case in the court of law. And so some of the themes are a lot more lofty and it can be difficult to get through. So maybe we could go around and start kind of just putting some things in our own words a little bit. Maybe that first image, right? The quality of mercy is not strange. How would someone put that in their own words if they could? Mercy is what?
Easy.
Mercy is easy, great. It droppeth as the gentle rain from heaven upon the place beneath. There's that nice, gentle water drop coming down, right? It is twice blessed. It blesseth him that gives and him that takes. So, in your own words, mercy blesses twice because...
giver and the taker.
The giver and the taker are both blessed by the mercy. Fantastic. And then it gets into the lofty terms of the kings. 'Tis mightiest in the mightiest. It becomes the throned monarch better than his crown. So it's in something that's in all of the kings, right? His scepter, and here we talk about the king's authority, the image of the king, shows the force of temporal power, the attribute to awe and majesty. So the scepter is strong and powerful, wherein doth sit the dread and fear of kings. So people, you know, fear that authority, that power. But mercy is above this sceptered sway. It is enthroned in the hearts of kings. It is an attribute to God itself. So you can imagine, you know, the throne of a king. And then, you know, that place of power where a king would sit. But then within that throne sits a king. And he holds his scepter. He's the king that everyone knows and loves. And then within his heart sits another throne. And on that throne is seated mercy. And so I think that's a beautiful image that just kind of compounds upon itself. And she goes as far to say it is an attribute to God himself. Right? And earthly power doth then show likest gods when mercy seasons justice. And earthly power shows like gods when mercy seasons justice. So, can anyone put that in their own words? Mercy.
Complements justice or something?
So, earthly power is shown like God's power. When mercy does what?
Results in justice.
Results is an interesting verb, but she uses something different. She says seasons, right? Yeah, I almost, when I read this speech, I almost think of seasoning like Thanksgiving turkey or something like that, right? Yeah. You just add a little bit of zest, a little bit of rosemary, and it just brings out the flavor, right? It makes it pop. It makes it taste good, right? And I like that idea of mercy seasoning justice, just a like sprinkling on top of justice that really makes justice is what it is. What's that?
Resulting better.
I think tell mercy, Shakespeare.
It's a, but you have the advantage of, you know, 400 years of human development to thank for the insight. But I do like it quite a lot.
Yeah. Thank you. No, I agree. I wish it was. Yeah. We'll rewrite it for
softens or compromises.
Yeah, softens. And there's all these like gentle, earlier in the speech, gentle. There's all these words and images that go around how small of a thing mercy actually is. You know? It's seasoning. It's a raindrop. It's just the smallest little thing that has tremendous implications that makes Earth's power as close to God's power as it can be. So with this small little kernel of mercy, the implications are, you know, universal.
"'Tis mightiest in the mightiest" is just saying, like, mercy is the greatest mercy is found in the strongest ruler.
The strongest ruler has the mightiest amount of mercy in him.
Right.
Yeah, or her. Great. "Therefore, though justice be thy plea, though you ask for justice, that in the course of justice none of us should see salvation." I think there we're talking about, you know, the religious component of salvation and how we all ask for mercy in the judgment. we do pray for mercy, and that same prayer doth teach us all to render the deeds of mercy, because we ask for it so much that that we learn how to give it. And then the last is back to the court case.
So what exactly is she trying to say?
Does anyone else want to take a first crack at that? Something that Portia's trying to say. Well, I think there's a lot that she's trying to say in this. I couldn't even answer one correct answer for all that she's trying to say.
It would be saying that the best forms of justice are full of mercy because they end up being the most satisfying in the long run, and that it's almost a royal and godly act that's also very easy.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else to add to that?
I, given the context, read it as pretty disingenuous. Sorry about this praise and mercy. And it's very self-serving. Here.
Yeah.
And extolling the virtues of mercy, how, you know, it's heaven sent and it's mightiest and mightiest. And then, you know, it becomes a little bit cautionary. You know, without mercy, none of us see salvation. And so you're entitled to justice, but if you don't take this encouragement to be merciful,
Right. Yeah.
But how does it serve Portia?
It's not her husband who's getting cut, right?
No, it's not her. It's not her husband.
The Jew and...
But she's trying to resolve it, and it's self-serving. Don't let me put words in your mouth, but it's self-serving because she's just trying to get Shylock to give up and say, okay, I'm not going to actually kill him.
They all are sort of in league.
Yeah. Yes. And she is definitely in league with the Christians. She's definitely on the Christian side here. Yeah. Yeah.
But she has to pay a lot of money if he doesn't take the pound of flesh, right?
It is her money. it seems like this. Portia's really, really rich. So she's like, yeah, you know, whatever. Go. She has this speech where she's like, go pay him. Go pay him double, triple, whatever. So I don't know how much the money is a factor. But yeah, she's ultimately, you know, trying to get Shylock to calm down, to not pursue justice to the letter of the law, and to show mercy. And what I was saying, Anders, and what I'd love to bring you in on the conversation.
Everyone's okay. So, if everybody's wondering.
Oh, really?
Everyone's okay.
Something putting out fires?
Yes.
Yeah? Okay, good.
Yes, your question.
But yeah, I was just, we talked a little bit about revenge, and then we just looked at the mercy speech too, and I was just curious about, you know, what's in the Bible and what's in your teachings from mercy and revenge. It was something that I pointed out in this speech that I really take away as something amazing from it is that that mercy is something small. She compares it to a raindrop or seasoning. It's the smallest little act that has grand implications of, you know, being close to what God does when he shows us mercy, when we ask for salvation. Mm-hmm. And so with this small act can have great implications for good.
Yeah.
And that's you know, that's my thesis.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
That's good. I'm going to actually defer to Susan and Hannah because they both led sessions on mercy recently. But the one thing I do want to say that I think is connected from a historical... From a historical thing, I'm going to just lay out a framework that there was this movement that was happening just before all of this went on, which was in Protestantism kind of forming. And I think one of the hopes was that the Protestant version of Christianity was going to be more interesting or luring to Jews than Catholicism was or the Orthodox faith was. And so when that didn't happen, that Jews wanted to be Jews, I think Protestants
ended retreating to a nasty place again. And we find that in the writings of Martin Luther, and they're very pronounced that he was, as a young person, really excited about engagement with people of the Jewish faith, and then later in life had a very sour perspective on it. So I find that to be interesting, that it doesn't follow the actual practice of what I would consider mercy. And the only other thing I want to add is that this idea of when someone hurts you, that you should hurt them back, I think that that is like fundamental to life. Like when my wife gives a poke at me, my desire is to poke back. I mean, and you can think about it in everyday occurrences. If someone puts you off on the road, you want to then, and it's you're not your fault, but that there's something interesting about this idea of
eye for eye.
Right.
The eye for eye, tooth for tooth.
Exactly.
But they don't follow that today. A lot of things change.
Yeah. Well, and what I think I at least want to promote in my own life is trying to have an awareness of when I want to take the jab back, and that that's something I can choose to engage with differently.
Wait till you have a really good one.
Exactly. So I don't know if Hannah or Susan wants to give a short. I want to just. We're going to end at 9, so everybody knows that's about what, 10 more minutes?
No, 5.
5 more minutes?
2 more.
5. Oh, okay, well, 5 minutes. So within the little bit of time we have, we want to give you at least a minute for wrap up. But
yeah.
I don't know if somebody else here wants to speak to Mercy. Stephen, I think you could too. What you think it is?
This reminds me a lot of the parable about. In which Jesus answers the question of how many times must I forgive another person? And he says, not 7, but 70 times 7. And then he goes on this long spiel about this. There was a slave who owed a very, very small amount to another slave, and that slave owed a very great amount. And the other slave who owed a very great amount was forgiven his debts because he couldn't pay it. But then, as soon as he was forgiven for the debts that he owed, he went after his other fellow slave for the very small debt. And the parable goes that because he demanded the very small debt from the other slave, that he was basically tossed aside and put in prison because he would not forgive, or he would not forget the debt that was owed to him. But there is this in the end. There is a sense of revenge. There's mercy, and then there is sort of a revenge. Because he did not give mercy to his other fellow slave, revenge is placed upon him. And so, in thinking about both of these, of mercy and revenge, there is kind of, how to say, well, Jesus says kind of that if you don't give mercy, then you will receive revenge in the end.
Well, that's what the Lord's Prayer says, right?
Does it?
It says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. So, you know, the implication is, why should we be forgiven if we're not willing to forgive the people who trespass against us? Right? Sort of all summed up in that one line.
An interesting story came out in our Midnight Oakland group.
Do you live in Oakland?
I do, but this is with a group of students in Oakland who live in a
rough part of
Oakland.
Oakland's awesome. What's happening tomorrow in Oakland? They have a special night tomorrow night in Oakland? Telegraph?
Yeah, it's tomorrow.
First Friday.
Yeah.
Art gallery or something? Yeah. That's what
it's going to be. So, yeah, it's going to be a big party. Something, an interesting story came up, and I don't know, just to keep the conversation going and something to think about. He said that he had pulled a gun on somebody and decided to have mercy and to not shoot him. And he started walking away, and he got shot in his back. And we thought that that was the story, and that was what he was going to say. And it was like, oof, yeah, maybe mercy's not such a great thing. And that seemed to be like a consensus in the room, too, that when you show mercy, you're going to get burned. It's going to come back to bite you for it. And then he said, actually, well, hold up. And the point of his story was actually that then he still forgave that person who shot him and actually...
Because he pulled a gun on him, or just...
He forgave the person who shot him in the back. Yeah, yeah.
Are you paralyzing?
No, he's not paralyzed.
Wow. Well, that's a deep... This has all been very lovely. I just want to be conscious of our time. We can keep chatting, kind of informally, if you want to get another drink, but... do you feel like there's anything else that has been left unsaid that you must say before we can... conclude?
No.
Well, that was
terrific.
Well, then I'd like to say thank you. And I think everyone would join me in saying that the passion that you bring to this subject just shows your love of it.